Hi, I'm Wendy Padbury, and this is The Sirens of Audio.
G'day, audiophiles. This is The Sirens of Audio, the show that explores the universe of Doctor Who in the audio medium. I'm Dwayne.
And I'm Philip. G'day, Dwayne. G'day, audiophiles.
G'day, Philip. That was a nice reflection back to me.
Oh, well, yeah. It's all about building relationships and trying to mirror the other person. And you do it through motions and the edge. It was all about making friends and influencing people.
Yeah, very good. Oh, welcome to 2024. How is the new year finding you?
Oh, it's finding me much like 2023 at the moment, to be perfectly honest.
Nothing much changes, does it?
Nothing does much change.
We still get great stories when it comes to Doctor Who audio drama, so that's always guaranteed.
Indeed. And happy new year to you. Do you have a good celebration with your family? Or did you just all go to bed?
We probably just went to bed, I would say, more than anything else, because we've had a very, very... very busy couple of months, which I'll talk about briefly at the end of this episode, I reckon. That was my plan. Okay. So we have got the beautiful Wendy Padbury joining us for this episode in not too long. So if you don't want to hear us nattering away, you can fast forward to that. But please don't. We've got some interesting things to say at times as well.
Maybe. We'll see.
So... yeah, we'll see. But speaking of Wendy Padbury, Philip, what have you got to tell us about what Australian fans can enjoy?
Well, for those fans in Australia, we have Wendy Padbury coming out to join us in February. So only a bit over a month away now. So for those in Sydney on the 10th of February, for those in Melbourne on the 18th.
Very good. And I won't be there. So I'm very upset about that. But
yeah,
I'll get over it. No doubt.
The other exciting news too, just in terms of Charlie Haynes as well, Wendy's daughter, will also be appearing as well and doing a couple of special things during the events. And actually, I'll be mentioning her soon when we talk to Wendy, because she's been in quite a few Big Finish audios and a couple with her mum.
She has indeed. Even the very first one. No, not the very first one.
Not the very first one.
That's been... what am I talking about?
I don't know.
Before we bring Wendy on, there is one thing we have to do for the first time this year, Philip. Do you know what that is?
No. What are we going to do for the first time this year, Dwayne?
Oh, I thought you were going to surprise me there and say you did. It's time to jump down the rabbit hole. Let's go.
Okay.
All right. This is going to be an easy one, too. It's going to be easy to talk about, because I just want to talk about our first experiences with the character of Zoe Harriet and the Second Doctor, because you and I, growing up in similar time periods on television, we would have probably experienced Zoe at the same time on TV. What are your memories of the character of Zoe, just to start us off, Philip?
Good question. I mean, my first experience with Zoe would have been in the Target novels. So it would have probably been reading the War Games. I think the War Games would have been the first Target novel I would have read with Zoe in it. I'm trying to think of the order that they got released in, but that's one of the early ones. Then in terms of, so reading all the Target novels, the first repeat on ABC would have been, was it The Dominators and The Mind Robber? Was it The Crotons?
No. The Mind Robber first.
And then The Crotons.
Then The Crotons, yep. That was my experience too.
Yes. So I think that would probably be the first time on TV. I'm trying to think if I would have seen any videos or anything, bootleg videos before then, but I don't think I would have done. I think my first experience with Zoe would have been the books, and then, what about The Five Doctors? No. Yeah, actually, Five Doctors would have been first, 1983.
Would have been for you, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, the first time would have been actually the Five Doctors. I would have seen Zoe.
Okay. When you speak of the Five Doctors, I wasn't there for the Five Doctors live. I got the Five Doctors at the same time that I got the Seeds of Death on Beta. Those were my first Doctor Who purchases, the Five Doctors and the Seeds of Death. So Zoe was in both of those. So that was my first experience.
What year would Seeds of Death have been for the video, the VHS?
Video, it would have been, if it was on Beta, I reckon it would have been 89, 88, 90.
Okay,
something like that.
TV would have been first then before the VHS came out. Okay, because Seeds of Death was one of my first ones with her as well. That was on the first VHS I would have got.
I probably would have read some books. I would say The Invasion was one that I would have read, and The War Games too. I would have read as well. Those two would have been out, and I would have experienced those too. So, yeah. What was your impression of the character as opposed to, say, Vicky?
Is it always interesting? I always thought I would have preferred Vicky as the character. So in the books and in terms of reading information about the eras, you're reading all the summaries that fans used to write and all those things. To me, I thought Vicky was going to be the better character. But it's interesting, once I've now got to watch them on air, Wendy's a far better actress. And, as much as I really did enjoy meeting, I can't think of the actress name.
Deborah Watling.
As much as I really enjoy meeting Deborah Watling, Wendy Padbury was actually a far better actress. And there's a lot of screaming and a lot of very annoying things that Vicky does. But because we didn't watch the episodes, because I just read them in the Target novels or I read summaries about them, to me, I thought Victoria was going to be the better character. But having now watched them all, I prefer Zoe a lot more. And she's a lot funnier too. And there's some lovely little moments and some of the fight scenes of the Mind Robber. And she's just got so much energy and bounce about her, as well as being brilliant as well. She is actually a much more complex character, and she's not just a screamer, which unfortunately Victoria was. What about your impressions?
I've always preferred Zoe. I guess she was my first introduction to that era, and she sort of stuck with me as well. But I'm with you. I think I agree that she is she's a better, well-rounded character, because Vicky was a bit of, she was the stereotypical screamer from Doctor Who companions at that time, and Zoe wasn't so much. She had her moments. Don't get me wrong. She had her moments. But they did allow her to develop to a degree and use some of her sort of smarts, I guess you'd call it, her intelligence that she was introduced with back in The Wheel in Space. Throughout, she sort of went a bit more childlike in the War Games towards the end, but that was just the relationship she had with the Doctor. It wasn't a reflection on her intelligence, I don't think.
No, she was supposed to be young. She was only supposed to be 16 or 17.
Yeah.
So, she's very young. And the thing I was reflecting on too, in terms of they had hoped for her to carry over between Patrick Troughton and Jon Pertwee. And you can actually see, had she stayed on, she would have been the Liz Shaw. And so, the smarts that Liz
of course.
Has and those are the things, Zoe would have been doing all those things. And of course, Zoe could have done that. Zoe could have been scientific advisor. She could have been doing the tests. She could have been assisting the Doctor with his experiments. And so all those things that Liz did, you can see that Zoe could have done them as well.
So how interesting would that have been? What are your thoughts on the Companion Chronicles? Because she was in the first series of Companion Chronicles, and I know you're a big fan of them. Your impressions of Wendy in the Companion Chronicles?
Yeah, well, I really love her. I think she's brilliant in them. Probably the first one she's in, which is the Fear of the Dalek, is possibly one of the weaker ones, but there's some really great, there's a great trilogy of things, Echoes of Grey, The Memory Cheats, The Uncertainty Principle, that trilogy, and when you get to Simon Geary's writing, and then which is Charlie and about her memory coming back, those ones are just brilliant.
Yeah. And of course, no doubt we'll speak with Wendy about this directly.
Have you listened to many of her Companion Chronicles?
I've listened to a few, most definitely Fear of the Daleks. I don't have a clear memory of it. It was a long time ago. But I certainly have a huge fondness for her first appearance in Big Finish, which was Davros. She had a great role there with another season six actor, Bernard Horsfall, who a lot of classic fans would remember as Chancellor Goth as well from season 14. So that was a good pairing as well. And it was nice back in those days when Gary Russell was leading things to get some of those classic companions doing things that they would normally not do. And I think she did that really well.
Well, I think because it was Gary's policy to not allow companions to be cast against not their doctors. And so for those reasons, they just couldn't appear unless they were playing another character.
Yeah, but it was good. It was definitely good to have her there and to hear her voice. It was certainly a very, very different character to Zoe, that's for sure.
Yeah, and she did Jago and Lightfoot. She did Jago and Lightfoot as well.
I noticed that. Yeah. Mm. So she's had quite a varied number of roles within Big Finish. So that's good.
Yeah, excellent.
All right. Let's jump on up out of the rabbit hole. I'll let you choose what trailer we'll throw in to introduce Wendy. Pick something out of your hat, Philip.
Okay, I'm going to choose then The Memory Cheats, which was the first companion chronicle with her daughter, Charlie Haynes. So The Memory Cheats.
All right, here's the trailer for that. We'll be back with Wendy Padbury in just a moment.
Coming soon from Big Finish Productions, Doctor Who, The Companion Chronicles, The Memory Cheats.
What time is it? How long have I been...
47 days into cycle. I'm Jen. I'll be your defence assistant today.
The garment you're holding. Can I see? But the woman wouldn't share her precious rag. It was all she had left of her child.
The company says either you're pretending not to remember, or the memory loss is related to guilt and stress, a sign of your unstable character.
I stepped from the TARDIS into the hot, dusty street. We'd landed in the shade of a double avenue of trees.
That leaves 36 charges, including sedition, extortion, and threats to personnel. Computer says go straight to plea bargain.
And this officer, what does he look like? The waiter rolled his eyes. Well, he hasn't arrived yet. Then, how do you know I'm not him? You think I travelled in time?
We have evidence showing you did.
He saved the rest of us. Pointed his gun at the sleeping children.
What?
No!
Subscribers get more at bigfinish.com.
Please welcome Wendy Padbury. Wendy, thank you so much for joining us on The Sirens of Audio.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
So it's been lovely. We wanted to talk to you for ages. We are huge fans of the whole era and a lot of the stuff you've done, both in the show, which was a while ago now, but you've been back recently, but also your audio work as well. Now, do you want to tell us a little bit about where you were born and why did you become an actress in the first place?
I was born in Stratford-on-Avon in Warwickshire, Shakespeare's birthplace, obviously, as everyone I'm sure knows. And I didn't want to be an actress, actually. I wanted to be a ballerina. I was passionate about ballet when I was little, from as early as I can remember. And then I used to go to a Saturday morning ballet class in Stratford when I was really little. And then I think when I was about 9 or 10, maybe 10, they used to send scouts round to ballet schools. The Royal Ballet School, this is, used to send scouts round to all over the country, a bit like footballers do, I think. I think they have scouts, don't they? And they go off and watch people with to see if there's anyone out there with some sort of potential. And they came to my school, and my parents got a letter saying, we think your daughter has potential to be a... Anyway, I won this scholarship, which was a five-year scholarship to the Royal Ballet School. They offered five in the country at that time. So it was pretty prestigious. And the 5 years was for a year. The first year you started, really intensive, only ballet training. I wasn't allowed to play any sort of sport like swimming because you develop your shoulder muscles too much, any racket sports because you develop one side more than the other. I couldn't horse ride because of your legs and, or, you know, it was pretty full on. And I started my first year and it was all going fine, except they were always telling me to pull up my knees, to straighten my knees. And it was very quickly discovered that I've got very slightly flat feet. So not flat to the point where they look odd or that I have trouble with them, or, but they, as a ballerina, I don't have that beautiful arch that ballerinas have when you're on point. And it was proving to be a problem because from the waist upwards, I could present nicely, but my knees always looked slightly bent, and in fact, they weren't. And so at the very end of the first year, we had a week of exams at the Royal Ballet School with Nina de Valois and all the big ballet names, and I was chucked out, which of course at 10 or 11 was pretty devastating. However, I hadn't grown much. So I'm only 5 feet. And actually at that point, to be in the corps de ballet, you had to be 5'3". So I would never have even made the corps de ballet. And I didn't want to be in the corps de ballet. I wanted to be a prima ballerina. And I'd even got my name. I was going to call myself Wendovsky Padbarova because all famous ballerinas had, you know, Alice Marks was Alicia Markova. Everyone had a sort of made
Russian
up
sounding name.
Yes. So I'd got my name. I hadn't got the height. So it was after that, after the disappointment of that, that I realized I was never going to be a ballerina. And so I started taking little acting lessons in this same school. And then I thought, oh, actually, I quite like this as well. And then I, in the summer holidays, when I was 15, I wrote letters to agents and schools in London saying, I want to be an actress and can I come to your school? And one of them answered, I was too young for most because you had to be, I think, to go to the big draw, to RADAs, etc. You had to be probably 18. I'm not sure, maybe 16, but certainly not 15. But there was a stage school called Ada Foster who took people from tiny. You go through the school and they were in an agency as well. And they took kids up to the age of 16. So I got myself an interview and then I had to tell my mum and dad what I'd done. And my mum, they were both very supportive and mum took me to London, which was quite a big deal in those days, took me to London to have this interview. And they took me on. I then had to go back to my grammar school because I didn't want to go back, which of course in retrospect was a bloody stupid idea. Of course I should have stayed on at school. However, I didn't. They called an extraordinary meeting of governors in the summer holidays, and I had to sit and explain why I shouldn't come back to school. Anyway, they let me go. So I left school at 15 and went to London straight away. Lived with families and things. Boarded with families and came home every weekend, but started working, I think, in the first week that I was there. So there was no training. I wasn't going there to train. I was just going there to go on their books, do classes, do not really acting classes, but dance classes I did. but worked at the same time. And so that's basically how I...
So what kind of work were you getting?
I mean, everything. I mean, my first job was a television. I'd never even seen a camera before, not a television camera. And it was a sort of magazine type program that used to be on a Sunday night called Monitor. And Johnny Dankworth, who was a very famous jazz musician, and his wife, Cleo Lane, who is a very famous jazz singer, had made an LP. And they were just, for this magazine program, they were doing an article about the new LP. And it was all based on Dickens' characters. And all they needed was somebody who could look a bit waif-like and walk up and down the street looking in windows and looking a bit pathetic. And that was my very first job in the very first week I went to London. But it was brilliant because that's where I did see a camera. I saw a camera, a moving camera as well, on a rail. So I could, so what it was, because I didn't have any lines to learn, I could watch. I think that's what really helped, was just watching and looking and learning about lighting, a bit about lighting and a bit about the more technical side of things. So that was my first job. And then there were loads of jobs that I probably can't even remember that just kept coming. I was very, very lucky, actually. Really, really lucky. I think I looked younger than I was. And in those days, if they needed a 16-year-old or a 14-year-old, they would get somebody older who looked younger. Now they would get a 14-year-old, you know, but then it was very, there were a whole group of us girls, actually, that, well, my best friend at school was Elaine Page, and I spent a lot of time with Elaine because we're both tiny. Actually, I think she's slightly smaller than me, although she would argue that. But we spent a lot of time together, and we always went on the same auditions and stuff. And there were a group of us that used to go for auditions, and we'd go for coffee afterwards and say, who got the last job? Oh, you got the last job. It was probably my turn this time. And that's how it was sort of shared out by a group of girls that all looked much younger than their years, sharing out these jobs. It simply doesn't happen like that now, as I said, as you know, but it did then. And I think I was extraordinarily lucky. I put it all down to luck.
What was living in London in the early mid 60s like for a young girl?
Yeah, it was pretty, it wasn't scary. I was homesick, that's for sure, when I first went. And so when I didn't go back to Stratford at weekends, I used to go and stay with Elaine and her family. It was interesting. It was a real mixture of that flower power period where, you know, anything went. There were a lot of drugs around, not that I got involved in that because I was a bit nervy about that sort of thing. So that didn't affect me in any way, but it was a pretty fantastic time, actually, in the 60s, and particularly in London, I think. You know, it was really the happening place. Yeah, it was an interesting time. But I was away so much working, doing televisions, doing musicals, doing theatre. So doing musicals was an interesting one because I can't sing. But God knows how I got that job. But Elaine was in that as well. Elaine can sing, obviously, as I'm sure you're aware.
Yes, she can sing very well.
I was constantly working. So it was a really interesting time for me, mainly because of the work.
So Was your focus at stage going to be theatre? Was it going to be TV? Did you have a particular desire where you wanted to head?
No, not at all. It was just exciting to be thrown into the mix of everything right at the beginning as a truly inexperienced actor, you know. No, it was exciting. And I don't know, I think most actors say, when they're asked which is their favourite medium, they'll say whichever they're working on at the time. And that is certainly true. It's the job you love is the one you're doing at the, and that, you know, if it's theatre, that's what you're loving at that moment.
Could you take that path today as an actor, the path that you took, or is that only something you could have done back then in the 60s? Is that when things were right for that kind of path?
What do you mean exactly?
Well, you started off very young, and left school. Is that something you could do today, or is there a different kind of path an actor needs to take?
Oh, I see what you mean. I think it's much more drama school orientated now. I think you need to be. There are a couple of stage schools still left. I think. Certainly not the one I went to, but there are a couple. I think Fraser Hines went to a stage school as well. And Ada Foster, the one I went to, and Corona, the one he went to, were pretty famous at the time. But now, what an incredibly difficult profession. I mean, it's always been difficult, but now to get started, I think you need to do drama school. A proper grown-up drama school, you know, and do your courses and learn your trade. Of course, because there's not the opportunities to get there are millions and millions and millions of more actors than there were then in my day. So we were lucky, our little group, of sharing out those parts, because that simply wouldn't happen now. And the whole profession has changed now anyway. I mean, years ago, if you were in a soap, for instance, you wouldn't, it would be very difficult to get a job afterwards. And now it's completely the reverse. If you're not in a soap, you don't get another job. You need, it's so, so, so different.
So everyone starts now, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yes, absolutely. People, you know, get scripts used to be written because they were a good script and then it was cast. Now it's a lead character from EastEnders who happens to be flavour of the month or however you'd like to call it, but actually doing really well at that point. And then a script is written for them. It everything is different. Everything. And I became an agent, as you probably know, ages ago, until I retired. And it was tough for the actors, tough for our clients. I remember thinking when I was agenting that I would not want to be an actor now, especially an actor starting out. It's hard, really hard. And we had clients on our books, really good jobbing actors who I couldn't get a job for. You know, that was my job, to find work for our clients. And there was no rhyme or reason to it. It was the most frustrating job. It really was. It really was. But
what made you decide to go in? I mean, I was going to talk about it later, but what actually made you decide to become an agent?
An agent?
Yeah, what led you to that?
Well, I can tell you exactly what. I was still sort of working, sort of, doing, you know, children and blah, blah, blah. So work I didn't do a lot of because I didn't want to. And then I decided I'd do the odd job, and I did an episode of The Bill, which was a great programme. I had a tiny part. That was fine. But I hated it. I hated all the way it was done. I sat in a Winnebago and met nobody. I didn't meet the actor that I was doing a scene. I suppose because I'm old school, I didn't meet the actor I was doing a scene with. I didn't even meet the director. until I was, he waved a finger at me to tell me to start acting. And I thought, when I finished that, I thought, I really, really, really didn't enjoy that. And I'm not sure why I'm continuing doing this, doing something that I'm sort of fallen out of love with. And I sat around for about a year thinking, oh, see, I should have stayed at school. I might have had a brain that could have done something else. And at this moment in time, I could lean on. And I didn't. And somebody said to me, you'd make a good agent. And I said, no, I wouldn't. That's like a grown-up job. I've never had a grown-up job in my life. That means going to work and going to an office and looking after people. And they said, yeah, I think you'd be good. Anyway, that's how it started, because I got a phone call. Somebody needed help in their office. And I thought, oh, well, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. And I think it was when I said to my stepdaughter, I don't really want to do this. And she said, well, you can leave if you don't like it. You know, it's a job. You don't have to stay. And I said, oh, no. Okay. Yeah. So that made it slightly easier. But of course, I did enjoy it to a degree. It was hard work, but yeah, it was just the responsibility is enormous when you're an agent. You know, time work.
How many years did you do that for then?
16 years, I think.
Oh, long time.
Until I was 60, and then I thought, I can now legitimately say bye bye. I need to go now because it was a lot, and it was hours. You know, I go to work in the morning and finish at 6, and then I'd have to get in my car and drive to Sheffield or see a client in a. It was not just my weekends were taking up by taking casting directors to see clients all over the country. So it wasn't just a 9-to-5 job. It was much more than that. And it was pretty, it's pretty exhausting, frustrating. And when you see somebody that you think is so perfect for a part, you know, it's up to me to get that person seen. I can't get them the job because that's up to the actor, but it's my job to at least get them through the door. And sometimes that was really tough. A real battle to get someone seen. And when it worked, it was brilliant, really brilliant. And then my high then was not me getting a job and going, yee, I've just got Doctor Who. It was my thrill was my client getting a lovely job. So it had its moments.
I mean, it seems at the moment that particularly over in Great Britain, the same three or four actors are getting every single job. Like there's certain people that just every single production comes out.
They're off the screen.
And not they're not wonderful. I mean, Olivia Colman, fantastic, but she's on everything. And you sort of go, is there nobody else out there?
Well, that's the sad thing, of course. Of course there is somebody else out there. And that's one of the big frustrations of an agent. Of course there are other actors out there. Do you know what I was thinking only yesterday was I saw an advert on television for Marks and Spencer's. And it was a behind the scenes leading up to Christmas advert way of how they run their shop, doing their cooking for a Christmas sandwich and going behind the scenes. And one of the part of this program was making the commercial. The Christmas commercial for Marks and Spencer's. And they clearly spend an absolute fortune on this commercial. And one of the biggest things that the ad people in that were making the commercial kept saying was, we've managed to get the voice of Ryan Reynolds and somebody else, I can't remember who the other person is, to do the voices of these two mittens, animated mittens. And We're so thrilled. It's brilliant. And we're so glad we got them because obviously you hear their voice and they bring something to the... And part of me sat there thinking, Well, there are a million actors, voiceover artists in this country that could do equally as well. And you could save that money by, I mean, this is terribly naive of me, I know, but it was my immediate thought. I could think I could hand you five people that could do those voices as well as and bring something a little extra without you having to spend the money that I'm sure you've had to spend on a huge American star. It doesn't, to my mind, doesn't make any difference to the advert, because I don't think we as a public sit there going, oh, we have to go to Marks and Spencer's because they've used Ryan Reynolds as the, I don't think it works like that. The ad's either quite good or not. It's fine. But I just thought you could donate that money. You could donate that money to the homeless in the country. You could use that money that you spend on those famous people. I'd probably be shot down in flames for this, but that was my immediate thought. And I don't know how I got onto that, but it's a bit of a soapbox.
No, it's good to be passionate. I mean, I don't, at the moment, I don't want to talk about your Doctor Who career, but what is it like the fact that you've obviously had a very varied career? You did Doctor Who for 12 months, and yet this is the thing that keeps coming back to all the time. Are you bemused by the whole fact about even with the 60th now? How do you feel about the fact that Doctor Who is this thing that has followed you for decades?
It's quite extraordinary because, of course, we didn't know back in the 60s that it was going to be like this. It was, I think I was 21 when I was in it. And it was a great job, but it was another job. I think Fraser and I did one personal appearance once. In Selfridges, a book signing or something for some charity. And that was about as far as any external Doctor Who, using Doctor Who externally, went at that period. So fandom, I think, started way after, a big time, way after I'd left. And I know in the 80s they had, it changed actually when Jon Pertwee went into it, because Jon Pertwee was a much more commercial man. He had a much more commercial brain than Pat was very much to do his job, and his private life was private, and that it started and ended at work, and that and the rest.
I was going to say, Patrick was an actor, John was a showman. That was the difference between them.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. So there was a big change. There was a big change then. And I noticed sort of merchandise coming out when John, more merchandise coming out. So I was a very, very, very late starter. I kept reading about, that giant convention that they had at Longleat in the 80s, I think it was, where I was listening to the news and it said, if anybody's thinking of going anywhere near Longleat, don't go, because there's a Doctor Who convention and the roads are packed and you can't get anywhere, so stay well away from the and I thought, oh my goodness, it's massive. And it was John Nathan Turner actually that quite a few years later said to me, why, you are one of the only people that do not come to conventions. Why? And I said, because I probably don't remember. I just don't remember. Somebody would ask me a question that I won't know the answer to. And he said, you don't have to worry about that. He said, the fans know the answers. All you do is say, I don't know, but you do. What's the answer? And he said, it's, and he said, they'd love to have you. And I said, yeah, I don't know. It makes me very nervous. And he said, well, let's do one and see. So he took me to tiny school in somewhere like Merton, which is near Wimbledon, in South London. And it was a school, it was a school hall. It was a very small convention, probably about 300 people. And Nicholas Courtney was the main guest. And John said, we're not going to announce you, so nobody will know you're there. Even Nick won't know you're there. So, and then you'll see. And he said, and I'll introduce you and you'll come up and you'll see the reaction. And I went, okay, really? Okay. Don't leave me. And he went, I won't leave you. So anyway, I managed to see Nick in the green room. He was thrilled. And he was doing all his stuff. And then John said, I've got a surprise for you. We've got an extra guest today who's come to join us, her very first time. And it is, and then he said my name, and the whole room stood up and cheered. And I was like, oh, my goodness, I can't believe it. And then he started asking me some questions. He was very gentle on me. And the fans were amazing. And I thought, oh, I see. It's not quite as terrifying as I thought it was going to be. And that's how it started. And then I got a call from John Pertwee saying, they want you in America. Are you coming to America? And I said, I was about to work with John on Super Ted, a cartoon series that we did on the stage. And I was playing his sister, Blotch. He was Spotty Man, of course. He phoned me up and said, Philadelphia, I think it was. And he said, they'd love you to come. Do you want to come? And I said, well, I don't know. He said, my boys will look after you. And I said, I don't know who your boys are. And I think they were called the Ettinger brothers. And they were a couple of like East End heavies. And he said, they'll give you a ring. And my phone went and it was, hello, darling. And you could picture their faces, sort of slightly broken noses from boxing and fighting. And they were a couple of heavies. We'll look after you, darling. You don't need to worry about a thing. And I was like, oh, no, this is too terrifying for words. So I said, I don't think I can come. And I didn't go. And so it was quite a long time after that that I ventured to America. But again, it was with John, Nathan Turner, who actually physically took me. He took me to Chicago. So then I saw...
I was gonna say, would this have been happening before or after you did the Five Doctors for John?
Probably after.
Right.
Well, Longleat was 83, so it would have been after that, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, so it was all... Now, I love them, and now you can't stop me talking. It's a whole different... That's probably come with age, I think. but I've got to learn a lot more about Doctor Who over doing these conventions, I must say.
And so your first one was with John Nathan Turner asking you the questions. What's the difference between a producer interviewing you as opposed to a fan like Philip or myself?
There's not a huge amount of difference. Well, actually, the fans who do the interviews have much more knowledge of Doctor Who overall than, say, John did. John would be right on his own period and his own time as producer, but he wouldn't have known a lot about my time, before him. So actually, the fans are much more knowledgeable. I think John was being particularly kind on that very, very, very first little one we did by asking me quite simple, easy to answer questions. I was very, very fond of John. As an interviewer, I'd prefer a fan. Yes, they have much more knowledge and often ask much more interesting questions.
Now, I want to talk a bit about you coming back to Big Finish and reprise the role. It's interesting, after you left Doctor Who, you did the stage play as a very different role. Do you want to talk a little bit about Seven Keys of Doomsday? Do you remember doing that and how that came about?
I think I just got a phone call, maybe from Terence Dix. I'm not sure who phoned me. Because Terence had written it, and I had a conversation with him quite a while after about it, and he said he'd written it with me in mind, but he also hadn't, he wasn't sure that I was going to say yes to doing it. So it was a companion, it was a girl. But I was glad I did. It was... so technical as a show. It was a bit of a nightmare to do, actually, because it was huge. We had amazing special effects for that time. Because when was it? The 70s?
It was about 76, I think.
Yeah, something like that. So, yeah, that'd be about right. Because I think, my oldest daughter, Jo, would have been about 3. Technically, we had huge screens at the back of the stage with scenes on and special effects on and giant special effects, people on tops of giant ladders with costumes that fell to the floor and being wheeled. Technically, it was the stage manager's nightmare. And technically for the actors, every single line was a cue of some sort. And so a lighting cue or a sound cue or a pushing a piece of furniture on, it was a cue. So you were never allowed the freedom of any sort of ad-libbing or getting yourself out of scrapes if you got into them with your lines. We had to be absolutely line for line every night, which kind of takes away the slight spontaneity of things when you can't just tweak a couple of lines as you go along. But it was pretty spectacular. But I think it was the year that we were getting a lot of IRA bombings in London. And they were putting bombs in letterboxes, et cetera, et cetera. And people stopped coming. I mean, why would you bring your children into central London when that was happening? You wouldn't. And so it was supposed to, we finished our run, but they were hoping that it would extend. But of course it didn't. And so they were hoping to take it on the road. But the sets didn't fit into a lot of the provincial theatres. The dock doors were not big enough at the back of the theatres for them to put the sets in. So it all slightly fell apart after our run in the West End. I mean, it was great fun to do. And I remember saying to Terence Dix, that opening of the show, I thought was absolutely brilliant. It went, right, really? And I said, you know, we're having me and the boys sitting in the audience as if we're part of the audience. And then the lights go down and then smoke appears on the stage and then the TARDIS noise appears, sounds, and then smoke appears and the TARDIS lands and the door flings open and the doctor staggers out going, help me, help me. And so we, at the back of the stalls, I'd say, oh, that poor man, he looks as though he needs a bit of help. And the boy that was with me playing Jimmy, he said, well, I don't know what we can do. And then the audience around us, not knowing that we were part of the show, would start saying, shush, stop talking. In fact, I got hit over the head with a program once. Somebody said to me, will you stop talking? They must have been. And so eventually, after a couple of, you know, little couple of minutes of us going, should we go? Should we not go? Should we go and help? Let's go and help him. Look at him. Let's go. And we got up from our seats, ran down, up onto the stage, helped him. And where do you want to go? Back in. We took him into the TARDIS. And that's when our journey began. And I thought it was brilliant because I thought every child in that audience would go, damn, if I'd gone quick, I could have been in that story. You know, I thought it was brilliant. And all that Terence said to me was, I hated it. He said, it wasn't my idea. I didn't write that. That was the director. I never liked that opening. And I said, well, we're going to have to agree to disagree, because I said I thought it was a brilliant opening. Everybody, all those kids would have wished that they'd got up and gone and helped. Anyway, I thought it was great. It was a good show. It was a good show.
Here's our seats, Jimmy. Hurry up, it's nearly time to start.
Ooh, And what are your names?
Jenny. Jenny Wilson.
Jimmy Forbes. And what I want to know is...
How do you do? Very pleased to meet you. I'm the Doctor.
Doctor? Doctor who?
If you like.
The reactor must be recaptured and the rebels destroyed immediately. Has the Doctor been found?
Not yet, Your Majesty.
Order the guards to redouble their vigilance. The Doctor must not succeed in entering the base.
Who is this Doctor? Where did you meet him?
Why did he come to Khan?
He was after some kind of crystals. Said they're important.
I seek knowledge of the Crystal of All Power. What is its purpose? Why has it been divided and the smaller crystals hidden?
Knowledge of the Crystal of All Power is forbidden. Any who seeks it must be killed. You and your companions must be destroyed.
The success of our mission is far more important than the life of any one of us. Whatever happens to us, the Daleks must not get hold of the Crystal of All Power.
Stay where you are, or you will be exterminated!
I appear to be surrounded. It's almost as if you were expecting me.
Indeed we were, Doctor. This is your final defeat. From now on, the Daleks will rule supreme in the universe.
Ah, where's my sonic screwdriver?
Your daughter went on to play in the role for Big Finish, I believe.
I know. I was at a convention and somebody said to me, oh, what was it like hearing your daughter play your role? And I said, in the audio, and I said, I didn't know she had. We don't really talk much about work. I said, did she really? And they said, yeah. And I said, oh, I didn't know. I'll have to ask her. And anyway, about half an hour later, this fan came back and he'd bought the CD. And he said, you can listen to it now on your way home in the car. And I said, thank you very much. That's really kind of you. And I did listen to it on the way home. And I thought, I started listening to it and I thought, they must have recorded this without our knowing when we were doing the show. Because I don't remember being asked if they could record it, but I don't remember this. Anyway, it's about 5 minutes in before I realised it was Charlie. I honestly thought it was me. We do sound very, very alike, apparently. So, no, it was lovely. We were talking about it this morning, actually, because my ex-husband is here at the moment, Melvin Hayes, and he said, you both have a very similar intonation in your speaking. So, yeah, no, it was good.
I just jump back for a second to your time in the play? What's your memory of Trevor Martin? Because he had a large role in your last episode in Doctor Who. Well, a bit of a role. What are your memories of Trevor? What was he like as a man? I don't know much about him.
Do you know, I always thought he would have made a brilliant Doctor on screen, actually. He was a wonderful Doctor. He had... he didn't have the playfulness that Patrick had, the quirkiness, but... I don't think you can. I shouldn't, and neither should I compare him with any other Doctor. He was quite a dignified Doctor, if I remember rightly, and slightly unfazed. I suppose I was always used to Patrick's Doctor, who was chaotic and, you know, all over the place most of the time, eccentric and could be quite silly. And Trevor was a much more a straight Doctor who had everything under control, unlike Patrick's Doctor. So he was lovely, but he had a wonderful face. And I always thought you'd be lovely on the television as the Doctor. And I guess because he was so different, he was different to Pat, he was different to John Pertwee's flamboyance, but he bought a certain gravitas without the grumpiness, perhaps, of Bill Hartnell, the irascibility of Bill Hartnell. He was a straighter version. He was a lovely Doctor.
Was that a similar personality he had off stage as well?
Yes, he was delightful, absolutely delightful. He was fun. He was great fun. But there's a more serious side to him, I think, than any of the other doctors.
So after acting for a long time, you decided, after your bit experience, that you changed course slightly, became an agent. How did you end up coming back to work for Big Finish? Because the first time you came back was to do a non-Zoe role in an episode called Davros in 2003.
Yeah, with Colin, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah.
So how did that happen? How did that come about? Do you remember?
I just got a phone call saying we're doing, because it was a Big Finish early days, wasn't it? It was. I don't know how long they'd been going, but
about 3 or 4 years by that stage. So it's 20 years ago now that you did this.
Wow. Blimey, time flies, doesn't it? I just got a phone call from, I think, Gary Russell, because I think Gary Russell directed it. And he said, do you fancy doing an audio? And I said, sure. But I'm at work. Can we do it on a weekend or something when I'm not at work? So that's what we did. I think we did it at a weekend. And it was lovely doing something with Colin. I was Colin's agent as well. So
yep.
I remember saying to him, don't worry, I'm not taking a day off work to do this. We'll do it at the weekend. It was lovely, terrifying, but lovely. I always found, I still find even reading Big Finish stories pretty frightening. I don't know why. I find them a bit nerve-wracking. I don't know why. There's no reason, really, that I don't have to learn lines. I don't have the pressure of learning lines or anything like that. But there's still a responsibility. And then moving on to trying to get... I liked when they tried to recall... Zoe was able to start trying to recall her lost memories. Those were interesting. But I've done some really interesting stories, but I'm not the type of person, and I never have been, that will either watch myself on television or listen to the stories that I've recorded. There's no real reason behind that, other than there's probably a really good play on Radio 4 that I'd rather listen to than listening to my own voice. So story-wise, they've been interesting. Some have been, as always, some have been easier to read than others. Some have got tied up with plot, or they've given me quite a bit of, you know, technical stuff to say. The ones I've enjoyed most are the ones where I can just be Zoe. I mean, it's tricky. getting the voice, because obviously it's a long time, and I was very high-pitched and very squeaky when I was in Doctor Who, as Charlie keeps pointing out to me, because obviously with it being the 60th year, there's a lot of stuff on telly, and she goes, oh, there you are, Mother, in your squeaky voice, and then does an impersonation of me. So doing Big Finish, I haven't been able to, you know, raise the pitch of my voice to the point where I sound identical to the way I sounded before, but I don't think it matters that much. But they've been, and still are, and I've done some that I can't even, they come out, they take so long to come out. I've done three really, really good ones, really interesting ones, that aren't out yet, and you can't talk about them, but on the whole, they've been most enjoyable. The other most enjoyable thing with them is the actors that I've worked with.
Actually, could I just jump on that and go back to your first Davros? You not only work with Colin, but you work with Bernard Horsfall, who was also in the 1969 season with you. What was that like? Do you have memories of getting back together with Bernard for that recording?
Yes, I mean, it's as if there have been no years in between. It's extraordinary. And that's happened a lot, you know, either going to a convention and meeting a director, for instance, that I haven't seen since 1968. And suddenly the years in between have gone. And there you are, me saying sorry for things. You know, it seems to take you back to him being in charge and me being the actress that's providing the character of Zoe. And the same with Big Finish, meeting people that, actors that I've never met or worked with, who I've always admired, and meeting people that I've known and never worked with. So that's always been fun. I think they talking last time about me maybe doing one with Sylvester. Sylvester and I have become very, very good friends over the last few years because we both had houses in, well, I lived in France and he bought a house in France. And so we've seen each other a lot. And so I think, you know, that might be on the cards for the near future. Knowing Colin for all those years, and then working with him was a delight. People were a bit confused as to why I would be with a doctor that wasn't my doctor. But I don't think it doesn't matter. It's Doctor Who. I think you can do what you like. And I'm sure that if you spoke to Russell T. Davies, he'd say, why can't you? Why can't you do that? That's, you know, and probably with Russell, you know, if people said you can't do it, that's exactly what he would go and do. So I think, you know, there's no reason why you couldn't, I can't be with another doctor that isn't actually my doctor. Peter Purvis played, I did a story with Peter Purvis that I've known for years, him playing Bill, that doctor. Mm. It was just lovely. He's really good as well, yeah. Peter Purvis. I think he comes over really well. Yeah, I think so. So it's a wonderful thing that just it's like the gift that keeps on giving, isn't it? It's just carry on. And I find with this 60th anniversary, I've been a bit of an emotional wreck about it all. That's probably got something to do with my age, and also the realization, I think perhaps, of what I was and still am involved in this massive program called Doctor Who. It is quite extraordinary.
It really is. Now, you also got to work with your daughter Charlie Haynes in a couple of episodes of the Companion Chronicles. So, have you done much work? Have you done much work with her beforehand, or is this a rare thing?
No, I don't think we've ever worked together apart from the couple of Big Finishes. No, it's lovely. It's lovely. I mean, she's lovely. She's a much better actress than I am, and she's a voiceover artist. So she has a gift for accents and I don't know. She's just got a gift. You've either got it or you haven't. I haven't, she has. And she's exceptional. We have a laugh. I mean, we do have a laugh. And I bow to her better judgment. If I'm stuck on something, I will say, I don't know how to say that. Because sometimes in some of the earlier stories, they'd get me playing two or three other characters. And they'd say, don't make me do that, because you know I can't do accents. And I can't do, you know, that makes my toes curl when I have to do other characters. And when I have had to do it, and I've said to Charlie, I don't know how to do this. And she'll talk me through, just slow it down or make it, and then she'll give me some pointers as to how to do different things. So yes, she's a great help.
I think you're underselling your abilities, because I think you do some wonderful different roles in some of those Companion Chronicles, holding together so many different characters into your head. I think it's amazing.
Well, thanks.
I was just going to ask you too, in terms of, as you said, you're working with Fraser and Fraser playing Pat. How do you find that in terms of that dynamic of, you know, Jamie and Fraser also playing Pat and you? Is it a weird dynamic to go back to?
I mean, it was awful. No, I'm joking. I have to say that when, I don't know how Fraser did it actually, because sometimes we'd have our pages and Fraser would have two or three pages of dialogue, which was Jamie, the doctor, Jamie, the doctor. And then if he was playing another character, and so it went on, and he would flip, he would read it all in one. And we always in our separate booths then, we used to do it in a studio where we had our own separate booths. And I could always see Fraser out of the corner of my eye. And every time he did Pat, he physically turned into Pat. And he couldn't do it without doing the physicality of Pat's movements. I mean, it drove the sound engineer bananas. But if he could keep his feet still and still do the top half of his body without moving his feet and making noise, he was absolutely brilliant. And I took my hat off to him, how he managed to pull that off so many times. Now, as I'm sure you're aware, it's not Fraser, it's Michael.
Michael.
And with Michael as the doctor, actually, that just made my spine tingle, because he has got that. It could be Pat in the room. It could be. He's absolutely fantastic. All his little quirky vocal things that Pat used to do, Michael's got. He's just fabulous.
Dwayne will want to tell you that years ago, he predicted that Michael should be playing Pat, because...
Yes, I will tell you that. I'll say it again too.
I mean, hey, can I say, I mean, I loved Fraser too. I thought Fraser's, I mean, performance was just astounding in terms of the emotion he captured and the essence of Pat.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I know he was gutted when he was no longer doing the Doctor, but it makes absolute sense to me for Michael to step in.
Yeah, I think Michael's marvellous. So how did you manage to do the recording to be in France? Were you just traveling back to the UK a lot to do the recordings? How did that all work?
Oh, yes, it worked really well, because if they'd say to me, if you know when you're next coming to England, let us know and somebody will write something. So I'd say, you know, I'm going to be over in April. And so then they'd book me for a couple of days there so that they didn't have to pay my airfare. No, it wasn't just that. But I'd always let them know in advance if I knew when I was coming, and it's worked really well over the last years. Now, actually, I don't even have to go to the studio, although I will. The last one I did go to the studio, but actually Charlie has her own recording booth here upstairs. And during COVID, I did a couple of stories. Not during COVID, post-COVID, when things were starting to go back to normal, but still people were a bit reluctant to travel into London and stand in a studio. People were tending to do them under their stairs with duvets around and egg boxes to dull the sound. But Charlie has her own recording booth here. And so I did two stories from here, which I absolutely loved doing. Charlie set me up, and I don't even begin to understand the technical side of all of that, but she'd start me off in the morning, and I'd be talking to a technician who was asking me to tweak certain buttons and do this and do that. And so I learned how to do that for the sound. But the last one I did go into the studio because I like to be with the person that I'm working with. I think doing it in a booth is great. And, you know, in the absence of any other way of making recordings, then yes, I get it. But if you have the opportunity to be able to go into a studio and record, I'd rather do that. And I'd rather sit with the actors. And the last one I did, which was, Michael didn't come in. He was doing it from home. And I was saying, how dare you not coming to the studio? And he said, I'm still in bed. Roxy, bring me my champagne. And I said, that just isn't fair. That just isn't fair to not come in. Anyway, it's a good way of doing it, but I still prefer the physicality of meeting everyone and looking at who you're working with.
Yeah. There was a period of time. Oh, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, if Fraser couldn't turn up, it wouldn't matter. But, you know.
Hey. I know that's not true. Now, there was a period of time where you stopped doing all conventions and sort of retired from the convention scene. But you've recently decided to come back again. What was the reason why you stopped, and are you enjoying being back now and visiting again?
It was work. It was work. It was as simple as that. I needed weekends. The weekends I could get off, I needed off. And I didn't need to go to Sheffield and, you know, do as lovely as it would have been. I just couldn't do it. So there were a couple of years. It wasn't that long, actually, where I just felt that I needed my weekends off for work. So that was the reason. And then I don't know, somebody said, oh, don't be daft, you know, you could come to this one. And so I did. And the rest is history. And I love them. I love them from someone that would shake visibly at a convention. I now love them. And well, you meet all the same people. That's the joy. You meet all the same people, both in America and in the UK, all over the world, actually. But you also meet a new generation coming through and new people I've met. And it's a humbling experience, actually. I've met, I think, 5 astrophysicists. Even last year in New York, I met a young woman who was there with her father, who became an astrophysicist because of Zoe. And that is an extraordinarily humbling experience to think of the impact that the character had.
Yeah, we can't say we're really looking forward to having you down here in Australia.
And, oh, I'm excited.
Looking forward to all your stories.
Yes, great.
So anyhow, listen, thank you so much for joining us, and it's been lovely to be chatting with you, and looking forward to seeing you in person very soon.
You will indeed. I can't wait.
Coming soon from Big Finish Productions.
The doctor's been gone for over an hour now. What's keeping him?
All I know is he told us to stay in the TARDIS whatever happened.
Zoe Harriet! Jamie McCrimmon, as I live and breathe.
Eh? Who are you?
Ah, the eternal question.
The doctor wasn't running from him. He was running from that.
Cyberman.
But it seems to me that your average civilians are a bit eager to presume that these Cybermen are a thing of the past. Something that belongs in museums and shows and gung-ho hollow movies.
Aye.
I wonder, is that why I came here?
A signal from Talos. Cyberfleet will mobilize in 1.90 cycles.
Confirm.
Please! I'm
what's in there? Show me.
Oh, it's crawling out to my hand.
A cybermat!
Destroy! Destroy! Destroy!
Big Finish. We love stories.
Well, Philip, I am very, very jealous that I won't be able to be over there to meet Wendy face to face. But I was glad to be able to be in on that conversation. It was fantastic.
Yeah, she's a lot of fun. It's going to be an amazing event. Events?
Oh, you rub it in. Rub it in.
So yeah, it's going to be fantastic. So you won't be here.
No, it'd be fantastic. And based on the last few events that we've had and the enthusiasm of all the people who've attended, I'm really hopeful that this is just another one of a series of events that you can organise, Philip. Good one.
Thanks, Dwayne. It's going to be fun.
Awesome. All right. That only leaves us to recommend something or just inform our audience what we've been listening to.
And it's a new year, so it must be your turn then.
No, my list is here. Let me have a look at my list. Hang on. No, it still says Philip. It's your turn.
Oh, dear. Thank you for that. I'm going to recommend a Torchwood, which I haven't done for a while. But there's been the Ood, late last year was the Ood trilogy came out. And I'm going to recommend Ood Done It by James Goss. I mean, James Goss always does such a reliable, interesting story. So it's set in the future Torchwood after the Impossible Planet. And this is it Short? I think the actor is Sean.
I can't. He's been in one so before, small. Hasn't he?
Okay, my glasses are gone, and I just can't see. But Silas Carlson is playing the Ood, and Sean. And I can't think of your name, Sean. I didn't look it up properly. Is playing the main Torchwood character. But basically, they go to this recycling planet. And there's been an Ood death, and it's a whodunit in terms of who's doing all the killing and then who's trying to kill them. There's a proper denouncement at the end where he puts all the different possibilities in a room, and you know, and even the lines of, you know, you're probably wondering why I've gathered you here. It's just a lot of fun. It's a good whodunit. There's suspense, there's attempted murder, there's lots of murders. James Goss does some social commentary in terms of capitalism and how things work. There's an interesting lesson about how the American Railway was built, which was fascinating to listen to. Just very enjoyable, lots of information there. And it was just nice to have a really high-quality Torchwood. So I'm going to recommend that.
Excellent. Very good.
What about you, Dwayne? What are you going to recommend?
I'm going to recommend I'm going to do some shameless self-promotion. It's although it's just a little bit of fun, it's not really promotion for anything specific, but as you have gathered by now, I'm on a road trip and I have started putting out videos on a YouTube channel, which is called On the Road Again. So if you just search for @roadagain13 on YouTube, or I'll put a link in the description, you can follow my travels and check out some of the things I've been up to. We started off pretty calm, pretty cruisy. The adventure has started to get pretty scary in some corners of our adventures at the moment. So if you want to catch up with what I've been up to in between podcasts and how on earth I find the time to do these podcasts between what I'm doing, I don't know. But you can check us out on my YouTube channel. So there you go.
Brilliant. Be fun to watch. There's a video I want to watch about you getting sand, caught in the sand. I want to see how you get out of it. So,
my four-wheel driving. That'll be out very soon if it's not out already. Mm. All right. Thank you very much to you, Philip, and thank you to Wendy Padbury. It was been great to chat with her, and of course, Philip, it's been great to chat with you as always,
and you as well, Dwayne.
Until next time, we'll catch you later.
Bye, everyone.
This has been the Sirens of Audio, episode 184. An astrophysicist down under. With our guest Wendy Padbury and your hosts Philip Edney and Dwayne Bunny. Original theme music composed by Joe Kramer. More about us and tickets to Wendy Padbury live in Sydney and Melbourne in February 2024 from sirensofaudio.com. Comment below to give us your feedback or contact us via email at sirensofaudio@gmail.com or via any one of our socials. Thanks for listening, audiophiles. We'll hear you next time.